they like going in protein shakes. Why the club is better? It's not because they're sweet. Dude, that's happened to see one of the skunks. Like walking just around the side of the Cimarron.
That's all that's blue.
Yeah, apparently they're like Cimarron now.
Okay, why don't we go ahead and get started? So what did we talk about last time?
How the corporations are destroying music.
Oh yeah, aside from that.
That's the interesting.
I don't know that it's a corporation's fault, so we don't need to digress on that today.
So what kind of signals did we talk about last time?
Periodic signals.
And we talked about a method for representing those periodic signals known as the
Fourier
series.
What's the difference between the series and the transform?
Well, I'll answer that when we get to the transform.
Oh.
Last class we talked about the Fourier series.
Okay.
And we're about one class away from the Fourier transform, I think. So, what did we conclude about the frequency response of a periodic signal?
Periodic.
No.
Out of the frequency response.
You're getting save that answer when we get to the digital part of the course.
Harmonics and unknown frequencies.
Okay, what about them?
This is where there is a frequency response for
the signal. The signal has energy only at fundamental frequency in multiples.
Right. And
right. So you're on. So if you have some kind of crazy periodic signal. And I tell you that the periods are spaced by 1 second. What can you tell me about the spectrum? This is frequency.
You're going to have a big spike at, say, 1 hertz. Or
1 hertz, right. So
those are seconds.
These are seconds. So this is hertz.
And then lots of smaller spikes further out.
So one thing you can tell me is the Fourier series coefficients tell you you're going to have some energy at multiples of the fundamental frequency. And what's going to influence the amplitudes of these things?
The amplitude of the signal at those frequencies in a circular.
So the shape of this signal here is what's going to influence the envelope of the spectrum, whatever it is. But it's always going to have energy at multiples of the fundamental frequency. So if you're looking at a signal in a spectrum analyzer and you see this kind of a line spectrum, that tells you that it must be a periodic signal.
Well, if you spit a signal into a spectrum analyzer, is it going to just assume it's periodic and try to make sense of it, or?
Yeah, that's a question. I mean, it depends on the type of scope that you have. But if it's synchronous, if it's trying to sync to the signal, you're going to be a signal, so there's sort of an implied periodicity there.
So I guess it would just, like, I'd have spikes all over the place if it wasn't truly periodic.
Well, for a non-periodic signal, we'll see with the Fourier transform. The signal is just, let's say, some kind of pulse shape. The spectrum is going to be a smooth function of frequency.
Oh. So I guess that's the Fourier transform.
That's Fourier transform.
And we'll talk about that in one or two classes.
Okay.
But for the moment, we're focusing on line spectra. So what was the particular form of the Fourier series that we talked about last time?
The complex form?
We talked about the complex Fourier series, where we represented the signal as a sum of complex exponentials. What we'll talk about a little bit today is the trigonometric Fourier series and show you the relationship between the two. We'll then go through the pulse train example again. And then we'll talk a little bit about symmetry and about power and energy signals and properties. And we'll wrap up for you series today. So the trigonometric Fourier series, is, we introduced this last class. We actually spent most of our time on the complex Fourier series. But the trigonometric Fourier series has a DC term plus these multiples of cosines and sines. The analysis equations, how we find the AKs and the BKs, are shown here. They're derived in a method similar to what we talked about last time. The DC term, interestingly enough, is just the average value of the signal. So we take the signal, integrate it over a period, and then we divide by that period. So the DC, A0 is the DC value of the trigonometric series, which means if you have a signal like a sine wave, what is the DC value of a sine wave?
Zero.
Zero, right? Mm-hmm. If you have a cosine wave, what is the DC value?
Zero.
If you have a pulse, what is the DC value?
Zero.
That's a little hard. It depends on whether the pulse is, what the shape of the pulse is, right? Well, we typically think about a pulse as all positive going, right?
Right.
So if you have a pulse,
you
have this is going to have some, and we'll see this in a moment, some non-zero DC values.
Yeah.
We can then offset this by some amounts. Make it have a zero DC value. You've probably done that at the lab.
Okay.
The coefficients A sub k's and B sub k's are computed this way. We have an integral over a period of x of t times cosine k omega zero t. That gives us the value for ak. And then we have a similar integral for B sub k. Now, that gives us some insight. These A sub k's, if you have a signal, we have a signal that looks something like this. Which coefficients, A, K's, or B, K's, do you think are going to be used to model this kind of a signal? Well, certainly we're going to need some cosine terms, right? Because this essentially looks like a cosine. So the cosine terms, the A, K's, essentially model the, as we'll see in a moment, the even components of the signal. And the sine waves model the I components. So if we had a signal that looks something like this, and then it repeated itself, that's a signal that's going to look like it required it is a good model for a sine wave. So symmetry of the signal is going to play a big role in whether these coefficients are zero, whether they're weak, whether they're strong, that kind of thing. So A0 represents the DC, the average or DC value of the signal. These other coefficients, we can actually derive a relationship between the C sub K's and the A's and B's. C0 for the complex Fourier series is still just the DC value. The C sub K's can be found as, for K positive, can be found as 1 half of A sub K minus J times B sub K's. Because if you recall, this e to the JX, e to the JK omega 0 T, is really just cosine plus J sine. So the B's are essentially modeling the imaginary part, and the A's are essentially modeling the real part. So we can take the A's minus J times BK, and we can form the C sub K's. And then the C sub minus K's is just the complex conjugate of that. So we have 1 half A sub K minus J times B sub K. So if you obtain one Fourier series representation, you can easily convert it into any of the other Fourier series representations.
Do the A and B, this is kind of an oddball question, but do the A and B have anything to do with like expected value of a distribution? Kind of looks like the same.
Well, picking up on our wonderful Hilbert space discussion yesterday, the A's and B's are just the projections of the signal onto those axes. So A1 is the projection of the signal onto the cosine omega 0 t axis. It's essentially how much of the signal falls sort of in line with the first harmonic.
Is it sort of like the dot product?
Yeah, it's a dot product.
Oh, okay.
And similarly, the B's then are, in this case, 90 degrees phase shifted from the A. So these are, if you think of this as the real axis, then this is the imaginary axis.
And it's an integral because we're in a continuous space instead of a discrete space.
It's an integral because it's you're accumulating over the over full period.
Yeah. Okay. That makes sense.
Yeah. But yes, for the discrete Fourier series, we will see the integrals replaced with summations. So let's go back to our example of a periodic pulse train. We worked this last class with a complex Fourier series. We showed that the if we go through the integral of this, we can reduce it to this sine k omega 0 t1 over k pi. And we talked about the properties of that as a function of the index k. And we can also think of this as frequency, simply making this k times the fundamental frequency of 0 or k times omega 0. This signal has a non-zero DC value, so we can ask the question, what happens when k is equal to 0? We have sine of 0 over 0, and we'll try to deal with that in a moment. I'll show you that for trigonometric Fourier series, but you can use L'Hopital's rule to figure out what that is. But it should have a non-zero DC value, because this signal is all a positive going waveform. Now let's look at this in the let's now work this same problem using the trigonometric Fourier series. So let's begin with A0. We have A0 is equal to 1 over t times the integral from 0 to t of x of t dt. And this is not a terribly difficult integral to do. We're going to integrate. All we need to do is integrate over full period. That period can begin anywhere and end anywhere as long as it's one exact period. So one of the things you'll see as you start working homework problems is there's no reason to make these problems harder than they are. Instead of integrating from 0 to t, in this case you might argue it's easier to integrate from minus t over 2 to plus t over 2. So we'll integrate that way. And that's even a little simpler because we know that the signal is 0 from minus t over 2 to minus t1, and from t1 to plus t over 2. So we can actually reduce this integral to minus t1 to plus t1, and the value of x of t over that interval is 1. So we have the integral 1 over t times the integral of that, and hopefully you can work this these days, and that gives us 1 over t times t1 minus t1, or 2t1 over t.
Is that where the 2 comes from in the first equations you showed for a and b?
The 2?
The first one is just 1 over t, and a k and b of k, it's 2 over t.
Yeah, it's somewhat related to that. I mean, if you think about the complex Fourier series, it's sine plus j cosine, but now you're splitting that up into the a's and b's. So the C's essentially has a magnitude that's twice the magnitude of the A's and B's, so that's sort of where the half comes from. Now, does this result make sense? This is something that I want you to be able to do this semester, because I think it's important as engineers to be able to interpret results and analyze results. So let's think about whether we could test whether the asymptotic behavior of this result makes sense. So first of all, let's ask the question, what happens if I increase the value of t to something very, very large? What happens to the DC value of this waveform?
It's still going to be the same, shouldn't it? I mean, as long as you get the same number of pulses.
No, DC value won't be the same. So as you increase t,
it'll approach an asymptote.
DC value is the average value, right? If it was not the average value, then you could argue, well, it's not going to change. But because it's the average value, as you increase t, what are you effectively doing to the amount of time that that signal spends being non-zero?
Increasing it.
Over a period. No, t, not t1. We're increasing the period t. Right, so that's just moving this out. That's keeping this fixed. Right? So we're going from... We're going from... situation like this to a situation like this.
Oh, okay.
So as we increase t, increase the period, what happens to DC value? It decreases, right?
I thought you were asking about little t, and that's why you didn't make any sense.
So that's t1.
There's
no little t here. So you're the one not making any sense. So we increase t, and what happens? The average the DC value goes down. That seems to make sense, both from our result and from the plot. Yes?
If the duty cycle on that pulse were a lot greater, wouldn't the average value increase?
That's my next question. So what happens as we increase the duty cycle of the pulse?
It increases the DC.
What happens
value?
To DC value?
It
should increase, right?
Duty cycle increase.
And we see, in fact, with this equation, as we increase T1, the duty cycle does increase.
So
now, something I want to talk about in a couple minutes, is what happens to the frequency response as we change T and we change T1, but we'll get to that in a moment.
Okay. So T1 represents the duty cycle, and T is the period for a function with the same length of time for...
T is the period of the signal, right?
Right.
Fundamental frequency. So what you see, what you learn from this, is what's really important is the duty cycle, which is the ratio of T1 over T. Okay, so that equation seems to make sense. Let's look at C sub K's. We showed, let's continue this. We know that A0 is equal to C0. So if you recall, we had this expression for C sub K, which we can evaluate for C sub 0 as this expression evaluated when k is equal to 0. Well, unfortunately, that gives us a 0 over 0 form. But if you remember L'Hopital's rule, we can find the result by differentiating the numerator and denominator with respect to the variable of interest, in this case, k. And if you work through that, you can show, in fact, that you get 2 times t1 over t. So this result seems to... match what we computed with the complex Fourier series. So that's good. That's good. Now let's look at the A sub k's and B sub k's. So A sub k is going to be the integral from 2 over t, from minus t over 2 to plus t over 2 of x of t cosine t omega 0 t. And like before, we can reduce that to the range minus t1 to plus t1. And the value of x of t is constant over that interval, so we essentially have the integral of cosine, which is sine k omega 0 over t times k omega 0 divided by k omega 0. We evaluate that from minus t1 to plus t1. So we can go ahead and plug in those values. And we can make use of the fact that sine of minus, you know, sine of minus x is equal to minus sine of x. So we can actually combine these into 4 sine k omega 0 t1 over k omega 0 t. So that's interesting. It seems reasonable since the form of that is very similar to c sub k. But let's look now at what happens when we compute that same result for the b sub k's. So for b sub k, we have the integral of 2 over t times the integral from minus t over 2 to plus t over 2 of x of t sine k omega 0 t dt. And again, we make that integral from minus t1 to plus t1. And that gives us minus cosine k omega 0 t over k omega 0 evaluated from minus t1 to plus t1. Now, cosine is what kind of a function, even or odd? And we'll formally introduce that concept in a moment, but I think you're familiar with the fact that cosine of x is equal to cosine of minus x, right? So what's going to happen when we evaluate this integral? We're going to get 0. Now, does that make sense? Does it make sense to model a signal that looks like this only with cosine terms? The a's are non-zero, the b's are zero. Well, yes, it does, because if you think about this, it looks a little bit like the positive going portion of a cosine signal. And if you think about how you can approximate that with cosines, we can sort of put one cosine here, and then we can come in with perhaps a cosine with twice the frequency to offset this part. And you'll actually look at this in MATLAB, but that's essentially what happens here. As we add cosine terms, we're able to reinforce this piece, and we're able to essentially attenuate this piece. And there's no reason to use sinusoids to model this signal. So that gets us to thinking about symmetry and about whether if signals have what's called even or odd symmetry or other forms of symmetry, what kind of impact that has on the values of these coefficients. And we'll talk a little bit more about that in a moment. But before we do that, let's sort of check this result with our complex Fourier series equation. So we have now a sub k and b sub k, so we can use our equation relating to c sub k's with a sub k's and b sub k's, and we can plug in our value for a sub k and b sub k, and we can essentially, it's pretty trivial here, to cancel the 2's, and we have essentially 2 sine k omega 0 t 1 over k omega 0 t. We can make the substitution of 2 pi over t for omega 0, and we end up with exactly what we got for ck evaluating the complex Fourier series directly. So these results do appear to match with what we got for the complex Fourier series. And I show you this because when you have to do these Fourier series, you know, do the easiest way. If it looks like you're going to have an easier time computing AKs and BKs, go ahead and do that, and then you can always get back to the complex Fourier series. So it really just comes down to what kind of symmetry the signal has. So, was our result surprising? Well, the answer is no, because x of t is an even function. Even function means that x of t is equal to x of minus t. That means that the value of this signal when t is positive is equal to the value of the signal when t is negative. Therefore, when we integrate a sub k's, we can make use of that symmetry, and we can write this integral from minus t over 2 to plus t over 2. We can actually just make that twice the integral from 0 to t over 2 of x of t cosine k omega 0 t dt. Now, similarly, when we have this integral from minus t over 2 to plus t over 2, we know that the portion of this integral from 0 to t over 2 is going to cancel the portion of the integral from minus t over 2 to 0, because you're going to essentially be subtracting those two. So the b sub k's for an even function are equal to 0. And that's a very important sanity check, very important observation about symmetry. Now, similarly, we can look at x of t as an odd function. So if x of t is equal to minus x of minus t, this is what we call an odd function. What is an example of an odd function?
Sine wave.
Sine wave. So we have a sub k here is going to be 0 because for similar reasons, we will have x of t now being an odd function, we'll get cancellation on the integrals. And the b sub k's can be evaluated as essentially twice the integral from 0 to t over 2. So even an odd symmetry play a very important part in how these Fourier series coefficients result work out, or the result that we get. Now, let's talk a little bit about what we'll come to know as the spectrum. So, we have our pulse train, we have our complex Fourier series coefficients, we can plot those as a function of k, and produce this picture, which we often call a line spectrum. In this particular case, the fundamental frequency t, a period, is equal to 8 times t1. So the duty cycle of this pulse is 1/8. Now this k, this thing we call k here, can be interpreted as k times omega 0. But omega 0 can be interpreted as 2 pi over t. So we can actually write this as k times 2 pi times f0, where f0 is equal to 1 over t. And therefore, it's customary to plot these pictures as a function of f0. So when we see, everywhere where we see an integer, 4, for example, that really represents 4 times f0. And f0 is an absolute frequency, so now you can directly compare the spectrum of two signals which have different periods. For example, if I increase the period t, which means I'm going to stretch out this waveform, what happens to the fundamental frequency, f0, which is 1 over t? So if f0 is 1 over t, and I increase t, what happens to f0?
It's going to decrease.
It's going to decrease, right? So how can we verify this? Give me a real-world example where you've observed this. What does this mean? This means the signal's going to have a frequency component in it, which is a lower frequency, right? So give me some real-world examples where you've observed this. There's, you know, it's all around you.
Drums.
How so?
You just change the speed of how quickly you hit it, or how sharply you hit it.
What about the size of the drum?
Yeah, size.
What about the size of the drum? That's a little easier, I think, for people to appreciate.
Bass drums tend to move air like.
When you hit the drum skin, what's happening? The drum is it's essentially a fixed membrane fixed at two positions, right? So it's going to vibrate. And in fact, it's going to vibrate in a way just completely described by the Fourier series. In fact, Fourier, when he invented the Fourier series, one of the two problems he was obsessed with, one was vibrating strings. He was looking at musical instruments and things, and just, you know, and the other, as I understand it, was the color that was given off when chemicals would burn. Another example that in my area of research, if you've ever wondered why taller people tend to have a deeper voice, taller people have vocal cords, which are longer. If you look down in their throats, they tend to have vocal cords, which are longer. They also have vocal tracts, which are longer. And that increase in length gives them a lower fundamental frequency. Because when you produce sound, you're vibrating your vocal cords. And the longer they are, the lower the frequency they vibrate at. Another example of this is if you're building buildings, right? When you build a low building, a short building, 2-3 stories, you tend not to worry so much about vibration of that building. But when you build a 100-story building, you start to worry about that. And in fact, the 100-story buildings start to resonate at frequencies close to, you start to worry about things like wind and other things because they resonate at frequencies close to that. And you can get into a situation where the building starts to vibrate in a somewhat unstable fashion. So when they build these tall buildings, they have to pay a lot of attention to how their vibrational properties so that they don't collapse. So this is actually a spectrum. Now the other thing that we can do is we're plotting the value of C sub K, which for this example happens to be a real number which has both positive and negative. The other thing we can do is we can actually look at the magnitude of the coefficient as a function of frequency, and that's often what we call the magnitude spectrum. And we can look at the angle of the coefficient as a function of frequency, and that's what we call the phase. But before we do that, let me just ask one other question. What happens to the frequency, what happens to this picture as I increase the value of T1?
It's going to have higher amplitudes further out.
So what happens to this equation as I increase T1?
It's just a frequency of the sound. The fundamental frequency is going to get smaller.
No, the fundamental frequency won't change. Because T1 is just the duty cycle, it's not the frequency. So the location of these harmonics will not change.
But their amplitudes will change.
Now as I increase T1, the pulse is becoming wider and wider. What do you think that's going to happen in the frequency domain?
To have more energy in the higher harmonics.
Is it?
Yes.
So the wider that pulse becomes, the higher the frequency content in that pulse? Well, think about what happens when you, in the extreme, when T1 is equal to T, it becomes nothing but a DC value.
So it actually decreases in the harmonics?
So the harmonics decrease in amplitude as you increase T1. What happens essentially is that this becomes a lower frequency signal. It's a little bit hard to see that without plotting these things, but that's what we will generally see later in the semester is that signals which are very wide in the time domain tend to have low frequency components. Signals which are very narrow in the time domain tend to have high frequency components. So as you increase T1 with that waveform, you're essentially strengthening the low frequency components of the signal. Now we can look at the magnitude in this case, and the magnitude of C sub K, which we can write as the magnitude of 1/2 times A sub K minus J B sub K, that can also be computed as 1/2 the square of A sub K squared plus B sub K squared. And the magnitude function for real signals, we'll deal to a large extent this semester with real signals, we can easily show that the magnitude of C sub K is equal to the magnitude of minus C sub K. So these plots will always be symmetric about zero for real signals. And that's actually one of the ways you can tell whether a signal is real or complex, is whether its magnitude plot is an even function. So this is the C sub K's are essentially an even function for real signals. Now for the imaginary part, on the other hand,
can be found by taking the ratio of the AKs and the BKs and such. And the magnitude function can be shown to be an odd function, because if you look at this result and you look at CK and minus C and minus K, it's easy to show that the angle of CK is equal to minus the angle of C and minus K. So for real signals, the angle or the phase function is an odd function. So magnitude function is even, phase function is odd. Now let's next talk a little bit about energy and power. Energy of a continuous time signal is defined as the integral from minus infinity to plus infinity of x squared of t dt. The power of this signal is defined as the average of energy over a period. So for a periodic signal, we can write the power as 1 over t times the integral from minus t over 2 to plus t over 2 of x squared of t dt. Now you can also think of this as the power of a voltage across a 1 ohm resistor. And this is exactly the same form of power that you're used to using in circuits. When you have a 1 volt sine wave applied to voltage applied to a resistor, how would you compute the power?
E squared over R.
And that's essentially what we have here. In fact, I think there will have a homework assignment where you can actually, you'll plug in x of t as a sine wave and you'll show the result that you get for power is similar to what you're used to with circuits. This is just a generalization of that, where we essentially, one view of this is we remove the resistor or we just normalize it to 1 ohm. But this concept of power is the exact same concept you're used to using in circuits. And later, when we start working circuits problems, we will relate the two. If a signal is periodic, obviously its energy is going to be infinite because the signal goes on forever. So with periodic signals, we tend to talk about power. With finite duration signals, like a single pulse, we tend to talk about energy. Now, if you recall our expression for x of t in terms of the Fourier series coefficients, we can derive an expression for the power in terms of the Fourier series coefficients. We can write that the power, this integral, we can plug in our expression for the Fourier series. And if you do work on this integral, I'm not going to show the full derivation here, but if you remember, when you take these exponentials and you multiply by another exponential of the same form and you integrate over a period, that term is going to be zero except when you're at the same frequency. So what happens when you multiply these out is essentially everything cancels except the ones where you have the same index for k. So you end up with just the sum of the c sub k squared. So this power of the signal can be written in terms of a sum over all of the coefficients, over all the Fourier coefficients, the sum of the magnitude squared. That in turn can be written as, in terms of the trigonometric Fourier series, as a0 squared plus 1 half the sum from k is equal to 0 to infinity of ak squared plus bk squared. That's sort of where the 1 half, the factor of 2 comes from. So, what's interesting about this is that we can now think of this plot of the line spectrum as what we call power spectral density, because we essentially have a plot of these c sub k coefficients. We plot the magnitude squared, we essentially have one of these at each harmonic. So this plot here, I'm showing c sub the magnitude of c sub k as a function of frequency. If we just plot the magnitude squared, which is just going to square these amplitudes, it's still essentially a plot of power at various frequencies. And that tells us a lot about the signal. It tells us that this kind of a signal only has energy at particular values of its harmonics. We can also then do something, we can plot the phase as a function of frequency, and that's what's often called the phase spectrum. So we have the phase spectrum, the magnitude spectrum, and then if we plot the magnitude squared, we have the power spectrum. And then sometimes it's convenient to plot the magnitude squared on a log scale, so we'll take the log base 10 of the magnitude squared.
How does the power spectrum compare to just the normal spectrum? Or what we were looking at before?
The only difference is the square of the amplitude of the Fourier series coefficient. That's one reason why we like complex Fourier series. The only difference between the two plots is it's just one is a square of the other.
So it would just be the magnitude squared from the line.
Right.
Okay. So it'll have the same shape, it'll just be exaggerated.
Right. It'll have the same okay. kind of relative shape, except that these things will be twice as, they'll be squared. So you kind of stretch it out. But the interesting thing is when you take the log of something squared is just 2 times the log. So they're all really different in the log space just by a constant. Now, something that we're going to see throughout the semester are properties of these transforms. And the Fourier series is the first transform that we've introduced this semester. And so I'm showing a table here of all sorts of mathematical properties, and you're looking at this and you're getting a bit overwhelmed, but by the end of the semester, you'll see that essentially all the different transforms we talk about share some basic properties. They have to have these properties to be useful to us. And some of the most important properties for them to have are things like linearity. What does it mean for a transform to be linear? Well, that simply means if you have a signal x of t and you take its Fourier series, and if you have a signal y of t and you take its Fourier series, you would expect that if you have if you have a times the first signal plus b times the second signal, that you could simply sum the Fourier series coefficients to get the result. And that is in fact the case, that the weighted sum of two signals, the Fourier series of that is essentially the same weighted sum of the Fourier series coefficients.
Is that true even if they have different frequencies?
Yes. Well, yes, that's okay. true. Except that, remember now, the Fourier series is only for periodic signals.
Right, so as long as they're periodic.
Right.
As long as the sum of the signals is periodic.
Right. Now, when we talk about Fourier transform, we'll generalize that. And then also okay. that's linear. Time shifting. If the signal is delayed, and then this is a really important property that we'll talk about throughout the semester. If the signal is delayed in time, that essentially produces a phase shift in the frequency domain, and that for the Fourier series amounts to multiplying each of the coefficients by a term e to the j. It's hard to see that, but you've got these in your books. It's just a screenshot of what's in your book, but it essentially produces a term which is e to the jk. omega zero, and then we have a term t. We have t zero, which is related to the time shift. So the more you shift this in time, the more you change the phase and the frequency. Now we'll actually go through these in more detail when we get to the Fourier transform. We don't usually go through these for the Fourier series, but I just wanted to introduce them for the Fourier series to prepare you for that. There are a couple other properties. What happens when you multiply signals? Well, you can actually convolve the Fourier series coefficients. Later in the semester, we'll come to know this actually as discrete convolution. You might ask about symmetry properties. If x of t is real and even, the trigonometric Fourier series is real and even. If x of t is real and odd, the trigonometric Fourier series is purely imaginary and odd. And then you can actually do some even and odd decomposition type things. And then what we showed on that previous slide is formally known as Parseval's relation. And what that says is that you can compute the power in the time domain or you can compute the power in the frequency domain, but you get the same result. In the time domain, you integrate the square of the signal over one period. In the frequency domain, you just sum up the magnitudes of the coefficients. So all transforms obey, all transforms we'll discuss in this class essentially obey these kinds of properties. So let's look at some examples of this with some signals, common signals that you're likely to encounter. Here we have the pulse that we talked about previously. Here we have a picture of its the C sub k's as a function of f. Actually, I think these are the trigonometric Fourier series. So you see that we showed that A0 had a non-zero value. The A's were non-zero and the B's were zero. And that's true because this is an even function. If we turn that pulse into what some call a square wave, basically offset it by its DC value, we can produce a signal whose DC value is zero, but still has non-zero A values and zero B and zero for the B's. So this is the only difference between these two signals, essentially, is this has a zero DC value. And that's actually, in the early days of digital communication, something we would do to prevent DC values from accumulating in the system. The if we take a triangle wave, well, this looks a lot like this kind of a signal in terms of symmetry. This is an even function. So what do we expect for the Fourier series coefficients? Well, we expect that the A's will be non-zero and the B's will be zero. That's fairly easy. This is drawn in such a way that it has a zero DC value, so we have A0 is equal to zero. But how would you compare the frequency responses of these two signals? Which do you think, which signal do you think has more high frequency components?
The pulse.
Why?
Because as you, it's a higher harmonics, it's got more frequency.
Because?
Yeah, well, it's got a DC value on top of it.
Right, so if you look at these two equations, you see that the triangle wave attenuates at the rate of n squared. The pulse attenuates at the rate of 1 over n. The triangle wave has a lower high frequency content. Its coefficients go down much faster. Now, why does that make sense when you look at these waveforms?
So triangles.
What contributes to high frequency content? Now, let's come back to the drums and the cymbals. The slope of the pulse. Tell me about that. Why does a drum or any kind of a percussion or whatever you call it, kind of instrument, why does it have a relatively high frequency? You know, you hear that ting. What is causing your perception of high frequency?
Air vibrating.
How sharp the pulses are, right? High frequency is associated with rapid changes. Anytime there's a rapid change in the signal, that generates high frequency. Now, so what we have here is a signal that's changing very quickly compared to here, where the signal is changing more rapidly. Now, I'll give you one of my pet examples of this is many years ago when I went to I'm from the Star Trek generation, so I'll tell you my Star Trek story, but I think it was Star Trek II where they did a lot of the digital stuff for relatively the first time. And I remember sitting in the theater being really annoyed because the pictures looked great. You know, they had this opening shot of the Enterprise and it's sitting there stationary and looked really good. Then it starts to move. And all of a sudden, when you looked at the picture, you could see jagged edges. And since I've actually worked in this field for many years, and I know that some of the algorithms and worked on some of those algorithms, you know, I'm very sensitive to this thing because I can see and hear these kinds of distortions. But what's happening when that image starts to move? If you've ever seen this with all the digital video coding, even today's very HDTV and all that, when do these algorithms work poorly? It's when there's very rapid motion. Because that's a lot of change and that's generating a lot of high frequency information, which is exceeding the ability of the digital compression technology to capture those changes. So when you're watching a high definition movie, look kind of at the image closely when things start to move. You'll also notice sometimes when there's significant changes in lighting. Sometimes you can see a shadow and you can actually see the digital noise around the shadow. I saw that on TV the other day with the new digital transmissions.
Is the noise there when you say you have analog transmission and it's just not high definition enough that
no,
you can see it?
No, and that's the thing. So I grew up on analog movies, and the nice thing about analog movies are when things pan, they stay in focus. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you know you're all a digital generation, you're used to this stuff, but I find it really annoying when digital movies pan. A lot of times you can really see that the image is noisy and it appears out of focus.
Okay, I took
my daughter to the Star Wars movie, like when they came out with the new Star Wars movies, and they still have the same problem. It's really, it's gotten better, but because to fix that takes a lot more bandwidth, a lot more disk space, so to speak. But it's still, you can see when they pan, like I think in Star Wars 1, there was that opening scene with the stadium or something during the races, and you watch them pan, and there's just a lot of stuff that's out of focus.
Did you notice anything like that made the big Pixar movies like Wall-E?
No, now the digital movies can sort of get around this because they're mastering the information digitally in some cases, and Photoshop and all these kinds of tools have anti-aliasing filters built in and things to try to mitigate this effect.
And it was never analog in the first place.
It was never analog, but if the movie was shot analog and then converted to digital, you will see this. So it's all related to this, that the sharp edges are what causes high frequency contact. So if something's smooth, it has lower frequencies. If it's sharp, it has high frequencies. The same reason when you pass your digital signals over cables, when they get, and you use a cheap cable, and they get rounded and distorted, that's why. Okay, see you on Friday.